Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rebecca Wildbear, MSERYT500. She's the author of Wild Yoga, a practice of initiation, veneration, and advocacy for the earth. She's the creator of a yoga practice called Wild Yoga, which empowers individuals to tune into the mysteries of that live within the earth community, dreams, and their wild nature so they can live a life of creative service. She's been leading wild yoga programs since 2007 and also guides other nature and soul programs through the Animas Valley Institute. Visit her online at www.RebeccaWildbear.com. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm excited to talk about the book with you.
So on one hand, I want my first question to be, what is wild yoga? Except you just said what it was. So I'm going to make my first question a combo of what is wild yoga and what does creative service mean?
Wild yoga is a practice that brings us back into loving relationship with our bodies, into loving relationship with the planet, and stretches our consciousness to be able to perceive intelligences greater than just the human mind. It really enhances our relationship with ourselves, with our bodies, as well as everything else around us. It kind of brings us back to the roots of yoga, which in recent years, yoga has become synonymous with asana practice, which is the physical postures of yoga. And that's one branch of yoga that's important. It helps us get into our bodies, but it really is only one branch. The larger practice of yoga originally has always been to deepen our relationship with our bodies, stretch our consciousness, and also connect to the world around us and our relationship to everyone and everything around us. And so my book brings that balance back in by including asana, but also including the larger aspects of the journey of what it really takes to bring us into greater alignment with our bodies and with all those other intelligences, dreams, our muses, nature, our deep imagination.
So I understand how yoga would stretch out your muscles and can be a real workout because you're holding a position or something, but make the connection for how that relates to bring us back to that, the origins. I mean, how does that actually work to bring us back to the origin, or how does that work when you bring us back to the origins to connect to other intelligence, to connect to dreams? What's the relationship between dreams and downward dog?
Well, I think if you people do yoga because it helps them feel better or be at their best. It often stretches us. Sometimes if you're in a physical asana practice of yoga, you can begin if it's flowing well. I mean, you might remember sports you played where you felt like your best self, where you were performing well. If you're in the flow of an asana practice, you're stretching and flowing and maybe doing things a little bit beyond where you think you could. Or you might be in touch with yourself and your body on a given day where you're like, wow, something's wrong, something's off. I'm not doing as well as I normally do. I'm not in the flow. I wonder what's going on. But either way, it's a way to check in with yourself and always trying to bring yourself back into alignment with the flow and with, like, you know, your better self that you're meant to be. And when we talk about dreams and we talk about the planet and the natural world, we're also talking about bringing ourselves back into alignment, but we're also expanding our perception of what that means. It doesn't only mean my body on the yoga mat. It means my whole self in the world and my relationship with trees and rivers and mountains and my relationship with my neighbors, you know, human and non-human. And so how do I bring myself into flow in alignment with that? And how do I notice when I'm not in the flow? And how can I be aware of that, name that, speak the truth about that, and change that?
So one of the things that I love about this book is just how beautifully it's written. And I'm going to read the first few sentences. I could have grabbed any random page. The coastal dirt road heading south ends in Puerto Blanco, Costa Rica. I awaken at dawn to the distant songs of an abundance of birds and take in the vibrant colors and shapes of palm trees, red hibiscus flowers, and a pair of scarlet macaws. Looking out toward miles of untouched tropical rainforest and the vast expanse of the ocean beyond, I feel held by the salty sea's moist, warm air. And one of the things that I found very interesting in this book is how you would merge, and is this part of the point, how you would merge. There are many places where you will discuss, you'll have a paragraph where you are in a place, and then two paragraphs later, you are talking about a yoga pose. And so talk about that.
Yeah, great reflection of the book. I love that. In many ways, I think in one place I say that, you know, yoga, that the wild world is always in a kind of yoga asana. Everything is itself in relationship to everything else. And so, yeah, when we look around at nature, I think that's why people, even people who don't do yoga or aren't even interested, sometimes people just like to go out into natural places and maybe they don't even know why and be there. I sense it's because there's a beauty and flow and artistry to the movements and stillness happening between everything, in everything being rooted in their bodies and their self and in communion, union, in movement or stillness with everything else, and in a flow that you can feel that has vibrancy in life. And I do bring that in some ways. To me, I think when I've done yoga, one reason I've loved doing yoga is because in those moments, when I'm in the flow of it, I can feel beautiful. Nature is. I mean, I'm not always thinking I'm so beautiful, look at the way I move, but I'm very often thinking, oh my gosh, look at that tree. It's so beautiful. Look how it's blowing in the wind. Look how the leaves are moving. You know, look at how the birds are landing. Oh gosh, it's so beautiful. But when I move in the wildness of my body, I can sometimes feel that same beauty that I see in the world in myself. Because I'm in a kind of a wild flow. And yeah, I bring that into the book because we move back and forth. You know, in some ways, to me, wild yoga, what I mean by wild yoga at a deeper level is something like bringing ourselves into our own wild nature flow in the same beautiful, natural way that the natural world always is. And in some ways, reading those passages, even if you don't spend a lot of time in nature, hopefully they might entice you to want to see what it's like in different wild, beautiful places and ecosystems.
So this is a little off topic, but maybe not. The best line that I wrote in my 20s, and it's a bit overwritten, but I was 24, had to do with high jumping. And when you high jump, you run as fast as you can toward the place where you jump. And if you're running too fast, you lose control and fly into the bar. And if you run too slow, you're not getting as much energy as you could. So the line I wrote was that you approach the ragged edge of control where instinct and euphoria set you free from time and consciousness. And that feels to me kind of like what you're talking about here too, when you're doing yoga or when you're just being out in the wild, where you can sort of lose track of yourself, or you become so much a part of that flow of yourself that there's no – one more way to say this is that in any athletic events I ever did, when I was doing my very best, I lost sense. There was no sense of friction inside because I was so acting. All the parts of my body were working together. Is this making sense?
Yeah, totally. It relates to me too, that place where we join a flow of, you know, people say, should you try, you know, you can't try too hard, but you can't not try. You know, you can't do nothing, but you can't push it too hard and control it. So there's a grace that comes when you show up to do your part in your movements and you enter something else that you're in relationship with. And that's when you're in the flow.
So I want to come back to the book in a moment, but can you relate this book and can you relate everything you're talking about to the wild yoga programs that you lead in nature?
Yeah.
And to the sort of initiations and the guiding that you do in nature.
Yeah, you know, I first of all, like when I guide programs in nature, I'm always attentive to the wild place where we are. Each wild place has a different, it's a different person. It's a different personality, just like each wild being is a different personality. They're not all the same. And it can feel like different wild places give us different conversations or experiences in them. So it matters where we are, and we're tuning our ears to listen. And part of the conversation in the programs I guide is for soul, is for people to find out and listen for, you know, their soul purpose, what they're supposed to do, the vision that they're here to live. That's part of what I think you asked a question earlier to come back to about creative service. What does it mean to be a creative service? Well, one meaning is to find our soul image or purpose, which isn't always a specific vocation or job, but oftentimes can be like a mythopoetics, like a myth that we're here to live. I have a lot of examples in my book about my story, and I also share some other stories of people who have been clients or I've been guiding, have been to some of the programs I've guided, to what I mean by that, which it can be hard to decipher because it's not a common thing that's talked about in the world. But, you know, it's a deeper purpose, like, you know, just fitting into the jobs or roles of our culture isn't going to help change too much. I mean, I think it does make a difference, and it can make a difference in people's lives and beings' lives. So sometimes that can be an important thing to do, but also, you know, for me, a bigger calling is inviting people into what I would call a mythopoetics, which can sometimes be about completely different from the culture that we see here, dreaming into something that's different beyond that, or could even involve ending that. It takes us outside, fitting in something, and instead, what we are fitting in with is the dreamscape and the landscape and the images that come from those, rather than from the culture. And those things can give us guidance. So when I guide programs, I'm helping people listen to these greater intelligences, their dreams, the land, their dreams in the land mostly, and their body. Those would be the top three. And some people to their muse. That can be sometimes harder for people to connect to and can sometimes take some time. But usually we can pretty immediately connect with the body, nature, and dreams, although those take time too if you've never listened to them before. But to listen to those higher intelligences for guidance, and then we're not just allowing our ego to live our life, which is usually the ego that's been taught to live exactly the way the culture says to live. Instead, we're listening to these greater intelligences for guidance. And, you know, what am I really here for? What should I be doing? How should I be in relationship while I'm here? What is mine to do?
So do you have your book in front of you?
Yes.
So, and if you don't mind, could you read some of page 52? Read as much or as little of it as you want, because I love it. And then after that, can you talk about that chapter? I think this is just such a great example of form equaling content in terms of the love for the natural world. And I don't want to read it because it's yours, and I'm sure you'll read it way more beautifully than I would. Page 52.
I'm on it. So okay, go ahead.
Yeah, read as much or as little of that as you want, and then talk about the chapter.
And the chapter is Receive the Love of Trees. I embrace a giant ponderosa pine overlooking the Utah desert and breathe in the scent of butterscotch. As I climb and reach for the next branch, the rough texture of the trunk touches my skin. I want to feel close to trees like I did when I was young. Pausing, I wrap my arms around the tree and tuck my nose into the bark. I feel nourished and am transported back in time. As a child, I lived in trees. The giant ash tree rising well over 100 feet in my backyard was the center of my world. Down the hill in a grove of pines, I played in pine needles, sometimes climbing to the tippy top of a tree, arms wrapped around the thin tip, the weight of my body gently swaying me from side to side. In summer, I crawled out on the farther branches of the cherry tree, eating more fruit than made it into the basket for mom's pie. The maple tree in the front yard is where I went to hide. Behind walls of leaves, I could see all, and no one could find me. Before anyone taught me otherwise, I sensed trees had feelings and inner lives. I knew they were living beings with whom to relate. They looked after me. I felt like they could sense what was happening inside me more than other humans could. They seemed to understand the secret wounds and traumas of my childhood, the ones my mind did not remember or know how to bear. I felt terrible sometimes, but I didn't know why. The humans around me acted like things were fine, but something felt wrong. I didn't know what it was or how to talk about it, but whenever I was in the trees, I sensed they understood me. As a child, I turned to the smell of pine and bark instead of human skin or voice when I hurt. I climbed into the branches of these elders to be held again and again. I trusted their love and wisdom. They nurtured me. Although I could receive their love, loving myself was a struggle. In my early 30s, I returned to the trees for help. Feeling their love, I remembered my wounds and developed the capacity to hold myself. Friends and therapists help too, yet humans get caught in their dramas. Trees are present and continually listening. Some people judge those who talk about their wounds, yet all people are hurt. Those who pretend to be okay are often the most wounded. How could anyone be intact, raised in this culture, living in it every day? Being loved and held gives us the strength to face what hurts. What happened in our childhood is often buried. As children, we are too busy surviving to feel. Yoga is about relationships, and love is the foundation. Love is as essential as oxygen. People seek it from others but have difficulty giving it to themselves. The capacity to love heals and enables us to care for others and give to the world. The axiom, love yourself, rarely comes with instructions. It may feel impossible or exhausting. Many people are taught to buck up rather than feel, but softening our hearts is essential to love. An affinity for trees is forever inside me. Wild yoga is rooted in the love of trees. And in the rest of this chapter, I kind of go on to honor trees. The next section, Sacred Citizens of the World, is, you know, kind of how I see trees as, in some ways, I see them as a higher intelligence than humans, and the way that that forests live in society with other trees, the way that they relate to each other and care for each other and communicate with each other, in many ways, to me, feels like they have some kind of intelligence that's greater than ours. I don't know exactly what to call it, an intelligence of heart, an intelligence of community. Maybe it's something that I can't even fully name, but a way of communicating, a way of giving to everything. They give to other trees, but they also give to so many other species. An awareness, it could be the scientific proof of all the sensing factors that they have and capacities, which are greater than the ones humans have, or at least the ones that we're aware of and use. Maybe we have more. Some argue that we have more that we're not using. That could be the case. I think it is on some level that we do have more that we're not using. But the rest of the book goes into my apprenticeship with trees, which I had for many years. You know, I'd say a big part of it was, you know, related to the struggle to love myself, which is at the core. It's pretty hard to do anything when you're hard on yourself. I mean, depending on how hard you are on yourself, if you're hard on yourself all the time about everything, or you don't believe in yourself, if you believe every mean thing that other humans say or think about you, certainly it can be hard to love yourself. So I would apprentice to trees in the capacity to love myself and the kind of strength that can tolerate, you know, what other people say and do and know that it's not about me. It's maybe about them or what they're going through, and that being with trees and their way of seeing each other and seeing me and loving really taught me in my bones a feeling to love myself and to trust myself, to the point where after some years of going to the trees regularly, now I can go to them. I almost feel them all the time in me. But if I'm in a moment of challenge, if I can't get out to them, of course, that would be my favorite thing if I can get out to them directly. But if I can't, I can remember them in my imagination and remember in my body what it felt like to be with them and still hear their voice and feel them with me to feel love. And that capacity to love enables me to love other people, too. I think I shared a story in the book of being triggered by my mom and you know, something she said and then, you know, relating that to our whole matrilineal lineage and the pain that might be in our feminine lineage related to patriarchy, which is often how women might control or press down on other women and even in their family, and how turning to trees was a way for me to feel the way that trees can sense the larger perspective of the world, you know, what's happening to everyone, not just themselves, and enabled me to see the situation too, not just what's happening to me in this moment, but the larger story of what's happening with all of my family, with all of the women, and then enables me to love. And then, you know, it's really a call for generosity. Trees are so generous in the way that they give to everything. And yet it's almost just hard to fathom the level at which forests are still being destroyed, given how little that we have left. There's a story I write in the last chapter about that in Canada in particular, but there's a lot of stories about forests being destroyed all the time. And so, you know, in some ways, this chapter is too a call to honor trees, their intelligence and everything they give us, and what we're losing of ourselves and our own healing and wellness by killing them down. A big part of wild yoga has been kind of the taking away from the idea that individual health and wellness can be achieved or cured by, you know, just one person at a time, because our health is connected to the health of the planet. It's connected to how many forests we have and how many trees we have left. So when we destroy forests and we destroy trees, we're also destroying our own health as well as destroying them. So this chapter and the whole book is really a plea to begin to look at health and wellness that way, and to honor trees for the wise beings they are and all that they give to us, and kind of more point to the insanity of what it would be to treat them the way that the dominant culture is treating them.
So thank you for all that. Can you go through, if you would like, go through the organization of the book, the movement of the book? So take us from sort of the introduction through how the book moves. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I start out slowly, at least I think so. In chapter 1, 2, and 3, the first one is listening to the intelligence of your body. So that chapter is just helping us arrive in our bodies and get back into our bodies and sink into our bodies in relationship to nature. And that feeling that nature is part of our body, as we get in touch with our body, you know, we can get in touch to a certain degree with nature because we are connected. And also a little bit opening to the mystery that lives in the body, which will be, you know, gone into in a deeper level in other chapters. The second chapter, we really go deeper into our connection with Earth. So whereas chapter 1, we're just connecting with our body to the planet, in chapter 2, we're actually opening to the planet as sentient being, as alive beings who we can relate to, have conversations with, listen to. And that chapter 2 goes through a lot of step by steps, because a lot of people are like, how the heck do I do that? If I've never been talking to nature, how do I start to have a conversation and be able to hear nature back? So we start out slowly in that chapter with the various steps. And I won't go through all the steps, but imagination and engaging our child self in the way our child self may have seen things, as I just read in chapter 5, is one of the important steps. Flowing in the river of your heart waters, that's kind of waking up our hearts. You know, a lot of why we can't have connections with our bodies, with the earth, or, you know, with others, with ourselves, has to do with, you know, trauma shuts down the heart. That's how you can survive, because there's too much going on to deal with, to take in, and there's too much pain to feel. So the heart gets shut down. It can't take in good stuff or feel the bad stuff. And so a lot of healing is opening ourselves up to feeling the flow of our hearts, which is also connected to rivers. When I look at the planet of this culture, when I look at just the United States, you know, as well as places all over the planet, the blockages in the river are related, I feel, to the blockages in our heart. Stuck. Nothing is moving. And we got to get things flowing. And one, I think, can lead to the other. If our hearts are open and flowing, it won't make any sense to dam rivers and stop their flow. You know, and when the flow, and when we're in a river, when I'm in a river that's flowing, I love spending time with rivers, really helps open my own heart back up to flowing if I'm stuck at all. So those three are just kind of getting us on the ground. Those are the opening chapters. Sometimes I tell people you might not want to go past the first three because it keeps getting more intense from there. The whole first section is the wild. So we're waking up our wild body. The fourth chapter is to embody our feral female ferocity. And I really love to engage this chapter because anger is often associated with ill health. It's often associated with, you know, there's a problem. And certainly, you know, sometimes it is. Sometimes anger is toxic and is unhealthy. And that's very true. And, you know, it should be noted. But it's not true all the time. Sometimes our anger is actually totally healthy. Anger can be a natural response to the breaking of boundaries, whether it's our personal boundaries or whether it's the earth's boundaries or whether it's anyone else that we dearly love's boundaries. So we should not shut down our ferocity if it's actually part of our healing and part of our protecting. And I think sometimes that being shut down in humans is part of the problem of why humans, there aren't more humans who are able to step up and act on behalf of the earth or act on behalf of protecting women or children or others who need it. So this book is kind of acknowledging the structural and systematic aspects of oppression in our culture and how, you know, only certain people are allowed to be fierce or have control and other people aren't allowed, even when there's protection. And it's using our connection to dreams and nature. I share some of my own stories to re-engage our ferocity. How can we get back into it? What are some steps that we can take, shining a light on its existence and inviting that ferocity back, and female ferocity in particular? And when I say female, feral, it's kind of a wild ferocity that can protect itself. It's not any kind. It's the wild protective kind. And female, I invite that because it's also a different kind of ferocity that I feel like can go back to some of the historically, there's an energy in women, and there's also the mama bear. There's archetypal energies of fierce women. And I just want to bring that back into being as a positive thing, which is, you know, an opposite way as it's seen in our dominant culture. I just shared about receive the love of trees, and that chapter is great for honoring trees, but it's also great for calling love back in. Love is the foundation of everything. It's really hard to take any action if it can't be sourced in love. And so, and it's very hard to be sourced in love if we're not loving ourselves and we're not able to access love. So that chapter is really helpful at that. Dreaming in the cave womb is opening to our dream life, which is a really big part of the journey to be able to let dreams guide our lives. So, and then the next sections of the book, Holy Longing and Beloved World, take us into whole different trajectories. The Holy Longing chapter is kind of the transpersonal. It's opening us up into the spiritual and soul connection, the transcendent. So we're opening to the sacred world, to me, which is very, very much a part of Earth, not separate from it. I know that sometimes spiritual or transcendent is meant to be, you know, we leave Earth, but not, I'm a nature mystic. And so for me, the Earth and the spirit are abiding. They're not separable. They're abiding in everything. And then part of that too is embracing what we love. You know, falling in love is a real guide for us and what really matters. You know, it's the idea of the inner beloved has been talked about a lot, but whether it's a person or an activity that we fall in love with, or the earth itself, or a tree, you know, when we follow what we love, that's just a real guidepost to what matters to us. And it really can redirect us from what we're doing, what we're in the middle of. It can wake us up and move us in a completely different direction, but one that we're called to go, that like that soul or mystery or the earth are calling us. That's a sign. It's a sign. Our passionate love is a sign. And then the next chapter, embrace grief and despair. You know, if we fall in love, guess what comes next? Part of it is grief and despair. I mean, when you love something, you will lose it sooner or later. And so it's impossible to love and not lose and not have grief. And in our culture, you know, we're not so great at grief. Other cultures have done better at, you know, grieving for days and days and supporting each other. And we kind of learn to just bottle it up and keep going. But that's just part of the blockage of the flow. I also talk about earth grief, which is what I Buhner talked about it as well. So I'm kind of quoting bringing his idea in. But earth grief, the idea that some of what we're feeling might actually be from the earth herself. And this is a novel idea to me that I think is important, because so often in our culture we're taught, if we're if we're feeling something bad, like negative, like a downer, then maybe we should go get some help so we can feel better. And I think this is pointing to that, you know, maybe we're just feeling what's true. And maybe what we're feeling, even if it feels bad, even if it's painful, there's a lot of ways grief can be expressed, whether it's rage or apathy or sadness or tears. You know, there's a lot of anxiety. You know, it's just there's a kind of emotional quality. And so, you know, we might want to listen and pause and see what it's about rather than try to bypass it and just feel better. You know, in fact, sometimes the you know, what can happen in when we're in our grief, especially if it's earth grief, that can be a place of receiving visions, just like dream visions that can come while we're awake or while we're asleep, that can give us ideas for how to act or how to respond. Making a pearl of vulnerability is often about our own. It's a kind of about our own personal vulnerability. Oftentimes our soul calling, it calls us into our deepest vulnerability, that we often get asked to do what might seem to be the hardest for us to do, to give our gifts away and to face, you know, the vulnerability and the sensitivities we were born with are often part of what give us our gifts. And so that chapter is kind of some personal stories from me and another tree story in there about me learning to twist a little more with a tree that I met. You know, certainly I have a lot of my own ego defenses, just like everyone else around not, you know, vulnerability. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a great idea because we've all been hurt. But, you know, the trees like Twist that have taught me to at least do my best. And I'm not always the greatest at it, but at least do my best to be open to seeing what the vulnerability might be teaching me and what the gift and the sensitivity might be here for, what it might have to offer. And then chapter 11, Descend into the Reverent Dark Mystery, is kind of about, it's, you know, like the dark night of the soul, going into the dark, going where you don't want to go. Often when you go on a soul or spirit journey, you know, the dark or the journey itself takes you to where you don't want to go, to lose things you don't want to have to lose, and to see things that are painful to see. And so I tell some of my story about that. Also, the dark itself is a place where the imagination and the possibility can grow bigger. So there's a lot in there about just having a relationship with the dark mystery, which people are like, what the heck is that? The dark mystery. I like to look at some of the scientific observations that most of the universe is in darkness. And they've demonstrated that what we can see and feel and measure is only about 5% of reality and the rest is darkness. And so even science is saying, physics is saying, you know, there's so much more to reality than we can see. And that's kind of what going into the dark is about, is looking around and wondering what else is here? What else am I missing? There's so much I'm not seeing. And in being able to open ourselves to seeing and perceiving more, it gives us more possibility for how we can respond in the world that we can see and in our lives and in our relationships. Play your part in the symphony. Kind of brings things together again. You know, I say play your part is a lot like my soul. If I'm living my soul, I'm embodying my soul, I'm moving in the flow of my yoga, I'm embodying my part, but I'm in the symphony. So it doesn't happen, you know, in isolation. It happens in relationship. It happens by tuning in to the symphony of the world, being aware of what's happening around me. And then how does my part, you know, I move it to jazz, kind of an improvisational ability to show up with life where I know what some of my notes and some of my gifts are and what do I hear happening in the world around me and where and how and where can I respond and engage in the music of life. And I also delve in that chapter a little bit to the dissonant symphony with all of the voices, the species being killed, so many voices. How do we engage in the symphony when there's so much dissonance? Anyway, so I talk about a journey that I had with ayahuasca that helped me kind of come into trusting my gifts. I think the one of the big takeaways for me is that for me and how my system works is sometimes the suffering and the problems can seem so overwhelming that it can be easy to downplay what I can bring and what I can do that can really make a difference. And in that journey, the plant medicine was really kind of incredulous in asking me to show up and believe in what I had to offer and act and not hold back. And then the last chapter, Beloved World. This is kind of about the journey. You know, a lot of personal growth journeys are about the journey itself, and there's not too much on, how do we give back afterwards, the creative service part. And this last section, Beloved World, is kind of where I want to spend the section in particular, really kind of coming into that as fully as we can. And there's probably still, I know there is still miles and miles more to go. There could be a part 4, 5, and 6, and maybe there will be sometime, but it's at least a beginning. And how do we give to the world? How do we take this journey and this understanding and the visions that we've been given, what we've come to understand about our gifts or who we are, healing ourselves, holding ourselves, and how do we bring that back to offering ourselves? And cultivating wild eros is, again, starting with love, because I really do believe that is the foundation, how to love and how not to love. I actually talk about a toxic eros, too, that's in our culture that's talked about as eros. But in this chapter, Cultivate Wild Eros, there's a lot of stories of real body, a real body love kind of knowing that we feel with our connection to the earth, and that love can happen in a very unusual ways that aren't talked about in our society that have to do with our bodies and our love of the planet. Courting the muse is connecting to the muse. And I did put that in a later chapter because for some people, I think it can come easily. I have met people who it just kind of shows up. But for a lot of people that I work with, sometimes that one, and it certainly did for me. I was having many conversations for several years before I was fully able to contact my muse. But anyway, I have some practices in there for how to connect with your muse and how to have your art and your creative work come from your muse, which to me is another power like nature and dreams in our body, sourced outside of ourselves, more intelligent than us, that can help us, guide us, and direct us in what's most worth saying, being, and doing. And then praying within the dark earth. This is kind of one of the chapters that I love because it's again going inside the dark, just like if you remember in chapter 11, we went into the dark. But this time we're not just going into the dark mystery, we're going into the dark earth, which also means going into the dark earth with the dark of all the devastation that's happening with ecocide and with the water systems and with the loss of species. And we're going inside the dark earth and we're praying not just for visions for our own purpose and in our life, but we're also praying communally for visions for the earth. How can we go forward? How can we live as a people? How can we act? And even if we have the sense, to know this, have visions of this and that, how can we enact in the world, given the systems of power, given the challenges, what can we do? What difference can we make? What is ours to do individually and communally, given these challenges? And also it includes grieving too, in part of it, but not just in isolation, with the earth, within the earth. And then engaging in radical dreaming takes dream work to another level, dreaming for the world, dreaming for the earth, dreaming, for species and lands, even asking specific questions. It's happened before that dream workers have guided people to ask questions like letting dreams guide their art, letting dreams guide the way they offer their work into the world. So in radical dreaming, I'm taking it very specifically to the place of how do we dream radically and ask the dream world for help in how to stop ecosystem and how to protect wild places and how to help the earth and how to dream for the species of the future of all species and the present. And stretch your consciousness takes us back to kind of a crux of wild yoga, which is stretching our consciousness. The whole book, the whole purpose is stretching our consciousness. Some yoga is just stretching your muscles. And I'd say the big part of wild yoga is stretching our consciousness. It's the whole purpose. And in that chapter, I'm also stretching us in some other ways, particularly with shadow work, not just individual shadow work, but cultural shadow work, communal shadow work, and also in reconciling with like what I call reconciling with the goddess, which is the feminine, which is kind of a theme woven throughout the book, honoring and listening to the feminine side of ourselves and also archetypal feminine and also women. And become a love warrior for the earth. And this is where we all lead. All the chapters lead here. Because ultimately, like I said earlier, our wellness is connected to the wellness of the planet and the wellness of all of our children and our children's children and the future of all species has to do with how we can protect the earth and live in a healthy way. And, you know, as you know, we're not doing that very well right now. There are some people doing great and fabulous things. But if we look at, if we calculate the number of lands still being destroyed, the number of waters still being polluted and water being taken and things like that, we're still losing very badly. So become a love warrior for the earth is bringing it back to how can we bring all of these practices that we gain and all of these strengths that we've gained to communally and individually and communally come together and develop our capacity as a warrior. And I love the concept of love warrior because the concept of warrior is often considered a negative concept nowadays. In fact, I listened to a patriarchal talk on patriarchy not too long ago, and warrior is a concept viewed as a part of patriarchy, as a bad thing, a negative thing. And I agree, there are definitely concepts of war and warring, especially, you know, men being forced to go fight wars for, you know, the country that don't really aren't really what they believe in or would fight for or really helping, you know, that are bad. But there's also, you know, kinds of violence that are not good and not healthy. But in this concept of love warrior, as I build on the concept throughout the book, I'm actually calling into action a healthy concept of warrior. And I'm calling us to visualize a healthy concept of warrior, not saying that we know it all, you know, or that I even know it all, but to call in the idea that fighting and protecting what we love and what gives us life and what gives everything life and what everything needs to live is actually a very healthy concept of a warrior. And bring it back to the idea of, you know, people protecting, you know, protecting lands, protecting people originally. And how do we bring that onto a larger scale now that we have the world in the state that it is, this, you know, kind of global ecocide? How do we bring the concept of a warrior and a love warrior for the earth together as we visualize and we take stock in what the actual problems are? Where can we go? You know, how can we visualize a concept that doesn't just buy into, you know, the fixes that our culture, and I know you know well about this because you just wrote a book on it already, but the greenwashing kinds of ideas that people have around, oh yeah, that this and that's helping the earth and this and that, but actually really take stock and look at what really is and is not helping and become a warrior who's willing to fight and take risks for the earth, for what will really help. Okay, you probably didn't mean for me to talk that long, but I went on.
No, no, that's great. I'm really glad you did. Thank you for that. And I'm thinking about the, you know, the whole warrior concept. We do have a very skewed response to that because we have, you know, because many of our experiences of and this ties back to the anger too, because many of our early experiences with anger may have been through abuse. And then also on a larger scale, we're used to wars of conquest. But then when we put it back into an embodied fashion, we can, we've all seen at least fictional accounts, but sometimes real accounts too of, you know, mothers defending their children or fathers defending their children, you know, and people, the way I sign my volume one of Endgame books is find what you love and defend your beloved. And that is something that we need to, I think that's something that needs to be rescued from its sort of the toxic versions of it that we've all become so familiar with. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. That's some of what I know you, I've seen you do in your work that I've admired, and also what I was trying to do in Feral Female Ferocity and in Love Warriors for the Earth. That I think in one place I put, you know, we talk about toxic masculine being violence and objectification of women and you know, kind of over focus on money and wealth and you know, too much and control and domination. And there's a toxic feminine to match the toxic mimic, toxic masculine, which is, I would say, is feminine, is a submissive and yielding, even to things that are harmful. And I say toxic masculine and feminine as archetypal energies that can exist in any of us. So not saying that they are this or that, but you know, a man can have toxic feminine qualities of being submissive and yielding when maybe he might fight just as much as a woman, but they're just kind of toxic qualities that don't help us bring us into greater health. If health is the wellness of not only our individual self, but the wellness of our planet and, you know, the community and the wild places that we live on and surround us.
So I'm going to change the subject. Thank you for that. That's great. And I'm going to change the subject. How did you, this book seems pretty radical to me. How did you have difficulty finding a publisher?
I wrote another book before this one, and I shopped that one for a couple of years and didn't find a publisher. And then I found a publisher. Then I found an agent who was interested in the idea of a book on wild yoga. And then I started writing some chapters and some concepts on it. And, you know, it grew as I was writing it. So I had a publishing deal before I had finished writing it. So, you know, I don't know if everybody knew exactly what it was going to be before it was done, but they were interested enough in the chapters that I wrote, and then they were, you know, interested as we went along. So it was hard originally finding a publisher as a writer of other books, but this book, the idea of the concept of wild yoga, actually kind of caught on pretty quickly once I did the work of turning in the, you know, the proposal and the chapters.
And maybe this isn't a fair question either, but one of the things in my books that I've had to fight for is that I call trees who, like the tree who lives outside the window instead of the tree that lives outside the window. Excuse me. Did you have any sort of biocentric fights like that? Or were there some things that you were like, I'm going to keep this, and you had to talk them into it?
There was some conversations about some different things. I believe since my publisher is a, like, does spiritual book work and things, I think they have probably seen, I think some of the arguments that I brought, they had seen before. So it wasn't too intense. But there were conversations around, you know, referring to trees or things as he or she, as a being. Also, like, you know, I wanted to capitalize Earth all the time because I see Earth, you know, like people would see God. So, you know, we had some conversations like that, but they were pretty open to my ideas.
That's great. Excuse me. So just a couple questions. We're running out of time. And how can people find out more about this book? How can people find out more about your work with Animus and your work with guiding? And then I'll ask you one more question after that.
Probably the best way is my website, which I know you read earlier, is Rebecca Wildbear, RebeccaWildbear.com. It lists the different programs and things I'm doing on it. If you want to see my Animus programs, you can also connect to animus.org. There's a link on my website to Animus as well. And you can feel free to email me. My contact email is on there. If you have any questions about the book or want to get in touch, there's a way to connect with me. And there's a yoga video on my website as well if you want to try out a 20-minute vinyasa practice to experience the asana part of wild yoga.
This is not my next question yet, but I mean my last question yet. But just how long are the guided trips that you do, just so people have an idea, you know, what to expect?
Yeah, I'm most trips are around at least 5 days, just to give us a time out in nature. We usually that way we can have 3 full days out there, because the first day and the last day are half days, are kind of coming and arriving. So 4 nights and 3 days. There's also some longer ones. I do ones that are like 11 days long. I do ones that are like 7 days or a week long. And I've also been, I'm also about to launch some that are online. So if people want to just try out the practices on their own and meet once a week, I'm about to start some of those too.
That's great. That's great. I guess two things. I got two more final questions. One of them is, so is there anything you wanted to say about the book? I haven't given you the chance.
Well, you gave me a chance to talk about the whole book, so I got to say a lot. I can't think of anything that I didn't get to say.
Okay. And then the other one is, and this is a question that we writers either love or hate, is so what are you working on next, and when do we get to see your next book after this?
it might take me some time. You know, this is one idea that I'm really enchanted by right now, and it's has to do with the muse. But I feel like when we write a book, the muse, my muse, it relates to my core sensitivity too. It's giving me a way of seeing something about the world that maybe not many other people can see and sense exactly the way I'm seeing and sensing it. And so it becomes challenging. I feel challenged to put language to it. So I feel like, and it's really an intense feeling. It's because like there's a passion, like it feels so important that I want to communicate this thing that I'm feeling and sensing and seeing that like other people aren't seeing, they're missing. And I want to say it. I think it could help if I could just say it and get the point across, but yet somehow I don't have the examples. I don't have the language and the words, to say it. So, you know, I'm experiencing that right now, and I have been for some time, but I haven't been able to, you know, do more than just take notes on the next book. So it's real hard for me to put into words exactly what it's going to be. But it does have something to do with what I would call structural discrimination, structural sexism, patriarchy, the way that relates to the earth, and kind of the contrast of what I would call being earth-centered. But it has to do with a particular way that I'm seeing or experiencing it that I just don't quite have the language to really explain it yet. But it's a very intense feeling in my body that I can't escape. So that's why I know I'll be working on it at some point. You know, I'll continue with my muse to try to be able to put it into words.
Well, one of the things I love about what you just said is, I don't remember who it was, but there was a famous writer. They asked this writer's opinion on something or another, and the writer said, "I don't know what my opinion is because I haven't written about it yet." And that's just so true for me. It's like, I don't know what I think about this issue. I have to write about it. And that's how we really learn. So I love that.
I agree with you. And I think that's one reason I really do love the writing process a lot, as hard and intense as it is it really, it's a personal journey into getting clear on what I really stand for, believe, feel, see, think is most important to say. But it takes time. For me to understand what I want to say, that hasn't been, something new that hasn't been said, that's the main point of what I'm trying to get at.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you so much for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Rebecca Wildbear. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.